This is Audible.
All children mythologize their birth. It is a universal trait. You want to know someone, heart, mind, and soul? Ask him to tell you about when he was born. What you get won't be the truth. It will be a story. And nothing is more telling than a story. Vida Winter. Tales of Change and Desperation.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The 13th Tale by Diane Setterfield, read by Bianca Amato as Margaret Lee and Jill Tanner as Vida Winter.
Beginnings. The Letter. It was November. Although it was not yet late, the sky was dark when I turned into Laundress Passage. Father had finished for the day, switched off the shop lights and closed the shutters, but so I wouldn't come home to darkness he had left on the light over the stairs to the flat. Through the glass in the door it cast a full-scap rectangle of paleness onto the wet pavement, and it was while I was standing in that rectangle, about to turn my key in the door, that I first saw the letter. Another white rectangle. It was on the fifth step from the bottom, where I couldn't miss it. I closed the door and put the shop key in its usual place behind Bailey's Advanced Principles of Geometry. Poor Bailey. No one has wanted his fat grey book for 30 years. Sometimes I wonder what he makes of his role as guardian of the bookshop keys. I don't suppose it's the destiny he had in mind for the masterwork that he spent 2 decades writing. A letter. For me, that was something of an event. The crisp-cornered envelope, puffed up with its thickly folded contents, was addressed in a hand that must have given the postman a certain amount of trouble. Although the style of the writing was old-fashioned, with its heavily embellished capitals and curly flourishes, my first impression was that it had been written by a child. The letters seemed untrained. Their uneven strokes either faded into nothing, or were heavily etched into the paper. There was no sense of flow in the letters that spelled out my name. Each had been undertaken separately. M-A-R-G-A-R-E-T-L-E-A. Margaret Lee. As a new and daunting enterprise. But I knew no children. That's when I thought, it is the hand of an invalid. It gave me a queer feeling. Yesterday, or the day before, while I'd been going about my business quietly and in private, some unknown person, some stranger, had gone to the trouble of marking my name onto this envelope. Who was it who had had his mind's eye on me while I hadn't suspected a thing? Still in my coat and hat, I sank onto the stair to read the letter. I never read without making sure I'm in a secure position. I've been like this ever since the age of 7, when sitting on a high wall and reading The Water Babies, I was so seduced by the descriptions of underwater life that I unconsciously relaxed my muscles. Instead of being held buoyant by the water that so vividly surrounded me in my mind, I plummeted to the ground and knocked myself out. I can still feel the scar under my fringe now. Reading can be dangerous. I opened the letter and pulled out a sheaf of 6 pages, all written in the same laborious script. Thanks to my work, I'm experienced in the reading of difficult manuscripts. There's no great secret to it. Patience and practice are all that is required. That, and the willingness to cultivate an inner eye. When you read a manuscript that has been damaged by water, fire, light, or just the passing of the years, your eye needs to study not just the shape of the letters, but other marks of production, the speed of the pen, the pressure of the hand on the page, breaks and releases in the flow. You must relax, think of nothing, until you wake into a dream where you are at once a pen flying over vellum, and the vellum itself, with the touch of ink tickling your surface. Then you can read it. The intention of the writer, his thoughts, his hesitations, his longings, and his meaning. You can read as clearly as if you were the very candlelight illuminating the page as the pen speeds over it. Not that this letter was anything like as challenging as some. It began with a curt Miss Lee. Thereafter, the hieroglyphs resolved themselves quickly into characters, then words, then sentences. This is what I read. I once did an interview for the Banbury Herald. I must look it out one of these days, for the biography. Strange chap they sent me. A boy, really. As tall as a man, but with the puppy fat of youth. Awkward in his new suit. The suit was brown and ugly, and meant for a much older man. The collar, the cut, the fabric, all wrong. It was the kind of thing a mother might buy for a boy leaving school for his first job, imagining that her child will somehow grow into it. But boys do not leave their boyhood behind when they leave off their school uniform. There was something in his manner, an intensity. The moment I set eyes on him, I thought, aha, what's he after? I have nothing against people who love truth, apart from the fact that they make dull companions, just so long as they don't start on about storytelling and honesty the way some of them do. Naturally, that annoys me. But provided they leave me alone, I won't hurt them. My gripe is not with lovers of the truth, but with truth herself. What succor, what consolation is there in truth? Compared to a story. What good is truth at midnight, in the dark, when the wind is roaring like a bear in the chimney, when the lightning strikes shadows on the bedroom wall, and the rain taps at the window with its long fingernails? No. When fear and cold make a statue of you in your bed, don't expect hard-boned and fleshless truth to come running to your aid. What you need are the plump comforts of a story. The soothing, rocking safety of a lie. Some writers don't like interviews, of course. They get cross about it. Same old questions, they complain. Well, what do they expect? Reporters are hacks. We writers are the real thing. Just because they always ask the same questions, it doesn't mean we have to give them the same old answers, does it? I mean, making things up, it's what we do for a living. So I give dozens of interviews a year, hundreds over the course of a lifetime, for I have never believed that genius needs to be locked away out of sight to thrive. My genius is not so frail a thing that it cowers from the dirty fingers of the newspaper men. In the early years, they used to try to catch me out. They would do research, come along with a little piece of truth concealed in their pocket, draw it out at an opportune moment and hope to startle me into revealing more. I had to be careful, inch them in the direction I wanted them to take, use my bait to draw them gently, imperceptibly, toward a prettier story than the one they had their eye on. A delicate operation. Their eyes would start to shine, and their grasp on the little chip of truth would loosen until it dropped from their hand and fell, disregarded, by the wayside. It never failed. A good story is always more dazzling than a broken piece of truth. Afterward, once I became famous, the Vida Winter interview became a sort of rite of passage for journalists. They knew roughly what to expect, would have been disappointed to leave without the story. A quick run through the normal questions. Where do you get your inspiration? Are your characters based on real people? How much of your main character is you? And the shorter my answers, the better they liked it. Inside my head, no. None. Then the bit they were waiting for, the thing they had really come for. A dreamy, expectant look stole across their faces. They were like little children at bedtime. "And you, Miss Winter," they said, "tell me about yourself." And I told. Simple little stories, really, not much to them. Just a few strands woven together in a pretty pattern. A memorable motif here, a couple of sequins there. Mere scraps from the bottom of my rag bag. Hundreds more where they came from. Offcuts from novels and stories, plots that never got finished, stillborn characters, picturesque locations I never found a use for, odds and ends that fell out in the editing. Then it's just a matter of neatening the edges, stitching in the ends, and it's done. Another brand new biography. They went away happy, clutching their notebooks in their paws like children with sweets at the end of a birthday party. It would be something to tell their grandchildren. One day I met Vida Winter, and she told me a story. Anyway, the boy from the Banbury Herald. He said, "Miss Winter, tell me the truth." Now what kind of appeal is that? I've had people devise all kinds of stratagems to trick me into telling, and I can spot them a mile off. But that? Laughable. I mean, whatever did he expect? A good question. What did he expect? His eyes were glistening with an intent fever. He watched me so closely, seeking, probing. He was after something quite specific, I was sure of it. His forehead was damp with perspiration. Perhaps he was sickening for something. "Tell me the truth," he said. I felt a strange sensation inside, like the past coming to life. The watery stirring of a previous life turning in my belly, creating a tide that rose in my veins and sent cool wavelets to lap at my temples. The ghastly excitement of it. Tell me the truth. I considered his request. I turned it over in my mind, weighed up the likely consequences. He disturbed me, this boy, with his pale face and his burning eyes. "All right," I said. An hour later he was gone. A faint, absent-minded goodbye, and no backward glance. I didn't tell him the truth. How could I? I told him a story. An impoverished, malnourished little thing. No sparkle, no sequins. Just a few dull and faded patches roughly tacked together with the edges left frayed. The kind of story that looks like real life. Or what people imagine real life to be, which is something rather different. It's not easy for someone of my talent to produce a story like that. I watched him from the window. He shuffled away up the street, shoulders drooping, head bowed, each step a weary effort. All that energy, the charge, the verve, gone. I'd killed it. Not that I take all the blame. He should have known better than to believe me. I never saw him again. That feeling I had, the current in my stomach, my temples, my fingertips, it remained with me for quite a while. It rose and fell with the memory of the boy's words. "Tell me the truth." "No," I said, over and over again, "no." But it wouldn't be still. It was a distraction. More than that, it was a danger. In the end, I did a deal. Not yet. It sighed, it fidgeted, but eventually it fell quiet. So quiet that I as good as forgot about it. What a long time ago that was. 30 years. 40. More, perhaps. Time passes more quickly than you think. The boy has been on my mind lately. Tell me the truth. And lately I have felt again that strange inner stirring. There is something growing inside me, dividing and multiplying. I can feel it in my stomach, round and hard, about the size of a grapefruit. It sucks the air out of my lungs and gnaws the marrow from my bones. The long dormancy has changed it. From being a meek and biddable thing, it has become a bully. It refuses all negotiation, blocks discussion, insists on its rights. It won't take no for an answer. The truth, it echoes, calling after the boy, watching his departing back. And then it turns to me, tightens its grip on my innards, gives a twist. We made a deal, remember? It is time. Come on Monday. I will send a car to meet you from the 4:30 arrival at Harrogate Station. Vida Winter. How long did I sit on the stairs after reading the letter? I don't know, for I was spellbound. There's something about words. In expert hands, manipulated deftly, they take you prisoner. Wind themselves around your limbs like spider silk, and when you're so enthralled you cannot move, they pierce your skin, enter your blood, numb your thoughts. Inside you, they work their magic. When I at last woke up to myself, I could only guess what had been going on in the darkness of my unconsciousness. What had the letter done to me? I knew very little about Vida Winter. I was aware, naturally, of the various epithets that usually came attached to her name. England's best-loved writer, our century's Dickens, the world's most famous living author, and so on. I knew, of course, that she was popular, though the figures, when I later researched them, still came as a surprise. 56 books, published in 56 years. They are translated into 49 languages. Miss Winter has been named 27 times the most borrowed author from English libraries. 19 feature films have been based on her novels. In terms of statistics, the most disputed question is this. Has she, or has she not, sold more books than the Bible? The difficulty comes less from working out how many books she has sold, an ever-changing figure in the millions, than in obtaining solid figures for the Bible. Whatever one thinks of the Word of God, his sales data are notoriously unreliable. The figure that might have interested me most, as I sat there at the bottom of the stairs, was 22. This was the number of biographers who, for want of information or lack of encouragement or after inducements or threats from Miss Winter herself, had been persuaded to give up trying to discover the truth about her. But I knew none of this then. I knew only one statistic, and it was one that seemed relevant. How many books by Vida Winter had I, Margaret Lee, read? None. I shivered on the stairs, yawned and stretched. Returning to myself, I found that my thoughts had been rearranged in my absence. Two items in particular had been selected out of the unheeded detritus that is my memory, and placed for my attention. The first was a little scene involving my father. A box of books we are unpacking from a private library clearance includes a number of Vida Winters. At the shop we don't deal in contemporary fiction. I'll take them to the charity shop in my lunch hour, I say, and leave them on the side of the desk. But before the morning is out, three of the four books are gone, sold. One to a priest, one to a cartographer, one to a military historian. Our clients' faces, with the customary outward paleness and inner glow of the book lover, seem to light up when they spot the rich colours of the paperback covers. After lunch, when we've finished the unpacking and the cataloguing and the shelving and we have no customers, we sit reading, as usual. It is late autumn, it's raining, and the windows have misted up. In the background is the hiss of the gas heater. We hear the sound without hearing it, for side by side, together and miles apart, we are deep in our books. "Shall I make tea?" I ask, surfacing. No answer. I make tea all the same and put a cup next to him on the desk. An hour later, the untouched tea is cold. I make a fresh pot and put another steaming cup beside him on the desk. He's oblivious to my every movement. Gently, I tilt the volume in his hand so that I can see the cover. It is the fourth Vida Winter. I return the book to its original position and study my father's face. He cannot hear me. He cannot see me. He's in another world, and I am a ghost. That was the first memory. The second is an image. In three-quarter profile, carved massively out of light and shade, a face towers over the commuters who wait, stunted, beneath. It is only an advertising photograph pasted on a billboard in a railway station, but to my mind's eye, it has the impassive grandeur of long-forgotten queens and deities carved into rock faces by ancient civilizations. To contemplate the exquisite arc of the eye, the broad, smooth sweep of the cheekbones, the impeccable line and proportions of the nose, is to marvel that the randomness of human variation can produce something so supernaturally perfect as this. Such bones, discovered by the archaeologists of the future, would seem an artifact, a product not of blunt-tooled nature, but of the very peak of artistic endeavour. The skin that embellishes these remarkable bones has the opaque luminosity of alabaster. It appears paler still by contrast with the elaborate twists and coils of copper hair that are arranged with such precision about the fine temples and down the strong, elegant neck. As if this extravagant beauty were not enough, they are the eyes. Intensified by some photographic sleight of hand to an inhuman green, the green of glass in a church window, or of emeralds, or of boiled sweets, they gaze out over the heads of the commuters with perfect inexpression. I can't say whether the other travellers that day felt the same way as I about the picture. They had read the books, so they may have had a different perspective on things. But for me, looking into the large green eyes, I couldn't help being reminded of that commonplace expression about the eyes being the gateway to the soul. This woman, I remember thinking, as I gazed at her green, unseeing eyes, does not have a soul. Such was, on the night of the letter, the extent of my knowledge about Vida Winter. It was not much. Though on reflection, perhaps it was as much as anyone else might know. For although everyone knew Vida Winter, knew her name, knew her face, knew her books, at the same time nobody knew her. As famous for her secrets as for her stories, she was a perfect mystery. Now, if the letter was to be believed, Vida Winter wanted to tell the truth about herself. This was curious enough in itself, but curiouser still was my next thought. Why should she want to tell it to me? Margaret's story. Rising from the stairs, I stepped into the darkness of the shop. I didn't need the light switch to find my way. I know the shop the way you know the places of your childhood. Instantly, the smell of leather and old paper was soothing. I ran my fingertips along the spines, like a pianist along his keyboard. Each book has its own individual note. The grainy, linen-covered spine of Daniel's History of Map-Making, the cracked leather of Lacunin's Minutes from the Meetings of the St. Petersburg Cartographic Academy, a well-worn folder that contains his maps, hand-drawn, hand-coloured. You could blindfold me and position me anywhere on the three floors of this shop, and I could tell you from the books under my fingertips where I was. We see few customers in Lee's antiquarian booksellers, a scant half-dozen a day on average. There is a flurry of activity in September when the students come to buy copies of the New Year's set texts. Another in May when they bring them back after the exams. These books my father calls migratory. At other times of the year we can go days without seeing a client. Every summer brings the odd tourist who, having wandered off the beaten track, is prompted by curiosity to step out of the sunshine and into the shop, where he pauses for an instant, blinking as his eyes adjust. Depending on how weary he is of eating ice cream and watching the punts on the river, he might stay for a bit of shade and tranquillity, or he might not.
More commonly, visitors to the shop are people who, having heard about us from a friend of a friend and finding themselves near Cambridge, have made a special detour. They have anticipation on their faces as they step into the shop, and not infrequently apologize for disturbing us. They are nice people, as quiet and as amiable as the books themselves. But mostly, it's just Father, me, and the books. How do they make ends meet, you might think, if you saw how few customers come and go. But you see, the shop is, in financial terms, just a sideline. The proper business takes place elsewhere. We make our living on the basis of perhaps a half a dozen transactions a year. This is how it works. Father knows all the world's great collectors, and he knows the world's great collections. If you were to watch him at the auctions or book fairs that he attends frequently, you would notice how often he is approached by quietly spoken, quietly dressed individuals who draw him aside for a quiet word. Their eyes are anything but quiet. Does he know of, they ask him, and has he ever heard whether a book will be mentioned? Father answers vaguely. It doesn't do to build up hope. These things usually lead nowhere. But on the other hand, if he were to hear anything, and if he doesn't already have it, he makes a note of the person's address in a little green notebook. Then nothing happens for quite some time. But later, a few months or many months, there's no knowing, at another auction or book fair, seeing a certain other person, he will inquire very tentatively whether, and again, the book is mentioned. More often than not, it ends there, but sometimes, following the conversations, there may be an exchange of letters. Father spends a great deal of time composing letters, in French, German, Italian, even occasionally Latin. 9 times out of 10, the answer is a courteous 2-line refusal. But sometimes, 6 times a year, the reply is the prelude to a journey, a journey in which Father collects a book here and delivers it there. He is rarely gone for more than 48 hours, 6 times a year. This is our livelihood. The shop itself makes next to no money. It is a place to write and receive letters, a place to while away the hours waiting for the next international book fair. In the opinion of our bank manager, it is an indulgence, one that my father's success entitles him to. Yet in reality, my father's reality and mine, I don't pretend reality is the same for everyone, the shop is the very heart of the affair. It is a repository of books, a place of safety for all the volumes once so lovingly written that at present no one seems to want. And it is a place to read. A is for Austen, B is for Bronte, C is for Charles, and D is for Dickens. I learnt my alphabet in this shop. My father, walking along the shelves, me in his arms, explaining alphabetization at the same time as he taught me to spell. I learnt to write there, too, copying out names and titles onto index cards that are still there in our filing box 30 years later. The shop was both my home and my job. It was a better school for me than school ever was, and afterward, it was my own private university. It was my life. My father never put a book into my hands, and never forbade a book. Instead, he let me roam and graze, making my own more and less appropriate selections. I read gory tales of historic heroism that 19th-century parents thought were suitable for children, and gothic ghost stories that were surely not. I read accounts of arduous travel through treacherous lands undertaken by spinsters in crinolines, and I read handbooks on decorum and etiquette intended for young ladies of good family. I read books with pictures and books without, books in English, books in French, books in languages I didn't understand, where I could make up stories in my head on the basis of a handful of guessed-at words. Books, books, and books. At school, I kept all this shop reading to myself, the bits of archaic French I knew from old grammars found their way into my essays. But my teachers took them for spelling mistakes. though they were never able to eradicate them. Sometimes a history lesson would touch upon one of the deep but random seams of knowledge I had accumulated by my haphazard reading in the shop. Charlemagne, I would think. What, my Charlemagne from the shop? At these times I stayed mum, dumbstruck, by the momentary collision of two worlds that were otherwise so entirely apart. In between reading, I helped my father in his work. At 9, I was allowed to wrap books in brown paper and address them to our more distant clients. At 10, I was permitted to walk these parcels to the post office. At 11, I relieved my mother of her only job in the shop, the cleaning. Armoured in a headscarf and housecoat against the grime, germs, and general malignity inherent in old books, she used to walk the shelves with her fastidious feather duster, her lips pressed tight and trying not to inhale. From time to time the feathers would stir up a cloud of imaginary dust, and she recoiled, coughing. Inevitably, she snagged her stockings on the crate that, with the predictable malevolence of books, would just happen to be positioned behind her. I offered to do the dusting. It was a job she was glad to be rid of. She didn't need to come out to the bookshop after that. When I was 12, Father set me looking for lost books. We designated items lost when they were in stock according to the records, but missing from their rightful position on the shelves. They might have been stolen, but more likely they'd been left in the wrong place by an absent-minded browser. There were 7 rooms in the shop, lined floor to ceiling with books, thousands of volumes.
"And while you're at it, check the alphabetization," Father said.
It was a job that would take forever. I wonder now whether he was entirely serious in entrusting it to me. To tell the truth, it hardly mattered, for in undertaking it, I was serious. It took me a whole summer of mornings, but at the beginning of September, when school started, every lost book had been found, every misplaced volume returned to its home. Not only that, but, and in retrospect this is the thing that seems important, my fingers had made contact, albeit briefly, with every book in the shop. By the time I was in my teens, I was giving my father so much assistance that on quiet afternoons we had little real work to do. Once the morning's work was done, the new stock shelved, the letters written, once we'd eaten our sandwiches by the river and fed the ducks, it was back to the shop to read. Gradually my reading grew less random. More and more often I found myself meandering on the second floor. 19th-century literature, biography, autobiography, memoirs, diaries and letters. My father noticed the direction of my reading. He came home from fairs and sales with books he thought might be interesting for me. Shabby little books, in manuscript mostly, yellow pages tied with ribbon or string, sometimes hand-bound. The ordinary lives of ordinary people. I didn't simply read them. I devoured them. Though my appetite for food grew frail, my hunger for books was constant. It was the beginning of my vocation. I'm not a proper biographer. In fact, I'm hardly a biographer at all, for my own pleasure mainly. I've written a number of short biographical studies of insignificant personages from literary history. My interest has always been in writing biographies of the also-rans, people who lived in the shadow of fame in their own lifetime and who since their death have sunk into profound obscurity. I like to disinter lives that have been buried in unopened diaries on archive shelves for 100 years or more. Rekindling breath from memoirs that have been out of print for decades pleases me more than almost anything else. From time to time, one of my subjects is just significant enough to arouse the interest of a local academic publisher, and so I have a small number of publications to my name. Not books. Nothing so grand. Just essays, really. A few flimsy pages stapled in a paper cover. One of my essays, The Fraternal Muse, a piece on the Landier brothers, Jules and Edmond, and the diary that they wrote in tandem, caught the eye of a history editor and was included in a hardback collection of essays on writing and the family in the 19th century. It must have been this essay that captured the attention of Vida Winter. But its presence in the collection is quite misleading. It sits surrounded by the work of academics and professional writers, just as though I were a proper biographer, when in fact I'm only a dilettante, a talented amateur. Lives, dead ones, are just a hobby of mine. My real work is in the bookshop. My job is not to sell the books, my father does that, but to look after them. Every so often I take out a volume and read a page or two. After all, reading is looking after, in a manner of speaking. Though they're not old enough to be valuable for their age alone, nor important enough to be sought after by collectors, my charges are dear to me, even if, as often as not, they are as dull on the inside as on the outside. No matter how banal the contents, there is always something that touches me. For someone now dead once thought these words significant enough to write them down. People disappear when they die. Their voice, their laughter, the warmth of their breath, their flesh, eventually their bones. All living memory of them ceases. This is both dreadful and natural. Yet for some there is an exception to this annihilation. For in the books they write, they continue to exist. We can rediscover them, their humour, their tone of voice, their moods. Through the written word, they can anger you or make you happy. They can comfort you. They can perplex you. They can alter you. All this, even though they are dead. Like flies in amber, like corpses frozen in ice, that which according to the laws of nature should pass away is by miracle of ink on paper preserved. It's a kind of magic. As one tends the graves of the dead, so I tend the books. I clean them, do minor repairs, keep them in good order. And every day I open a volume or two, read a few lines or pages, allow the voices of the forgotten dead to resonate inside my head. Do they sense it, these dead writers, when their books are read? Does a pinprick of light appear in their darkness? Is their soul stirred by the feather touch of another mind reading theirs? I do hope so. For it must be very lonely, being dead. Although I have touched here on my very private preoccupations, I can see nonetheless that I've been putting off the essential. I'm not given to acts of self-revelation. Rather looks as though in forcing myself to overcome my habitual reticence I've written anything and everything in order to avoid writing the one thing that matters. And yet I will write it. Silence is not a natural environment for stories, Miss Winter told me once. They need words. Without them they grow pale, sicken, and die. And then they haunt you. Quite right, too. So here is my story. I was 10 when I discovered the secret my mother was keeping. The reason it matters is that it wasn't her secret to keep. It was mine. My parents were out that evening. They didn't go out often, and when they did, I was set next door to sit in Mrs. Robb's kitchen. The next-door house was exactly like ours, but reversed, and the backwardness of it all made me feel seasick. So when parents' evening out rolled around, I argued once again that I was old enough and sensible enough to be left at home without a babysitter. I had no great hope of success, yet this time my father agreed. Mother allowed herself to be persuaded with only the proviso that Mrs. Robb would look in at 8:30. They left the house at 7 o'clock, and I celebrated by pouring a glass of milk and drinking it on the sofa, full of admiration at my own grandness. Margaret Lee, old enough to stay home without a sitter. After the milk, I felt unexpectedly bored. What to do with this freedom? I set off on a wander, marking the territory of my new freedom, the dining room, the hall, the downstairs toilet. Everything was just as it had always been. For no particular reason, I was reminded of one of my baby fears, about the wolf and the three pigs. I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house down. You wouldn't have had any trouble blowing my parents' house down. The pale, airy rooms were too insubstantial to resist, and the furniture, with its brittle delicacy, would collapse like a pile of matchsticks if a wolf so much as looked at it. Yes, that wolf would have the house down with a mere whistle, and the three of us would be breakfast in no time. I began to wish I was in the shop, where I was never afraid. The wolf could huff and puff all he liked. With all those books doubling the thickness of the walls, Father and I would be safe as in a fortress. Upstairs, I peered into the bathroom mirror. It was for reassurance, to see what I looked like as a grown-up girl. Head tilted to the left, then to the right, I studied my reflection from all angles, willing myself to see someone different. But it was only me looking back at myself. My own room held no promise. I knew every inch of it, and it knew me. We were dull companions now. Instead, I pushed open the door of the guest room. The blank-faced wardrobe and bare dressing table paid lip service to the idea that you could brush your hair and get dressed here, but somehow you knew that behind their doors and drawer fronts, they were empty. The bed, its sheets and blankets tightly tucked in and smoothed down, was uninviting. The thin pillows looked as though they had had the life drained out of them. It was always called the guest room, but we never had guests. It was where my mother slept. Perplexed, I backed out of the room and stood on the landing. This was it, the rite of passage, staying home alone. I was joining the ranks of the grown-up children. Tomorrow I would be able to say, in the playground, last night I didn't go to a sitter, I stayed home, by myself. The other girls would be wide-eyed. For so long I had wanted this, and now that it was here, I didn't know what to make of it. I'd expected that I would expand to fit the experience automatically, that I would get my first glimpse of the person I was destined to be. I'd expected the world to give up its childlike and familiar appearance to show me its secret, adult side. Instead, cloaked in my new independence, I felt younger than ever. Was there something wrong with me? Would I ever find out how to grow up? I toyed with the idea of going round to Mrs. Robb's, but no, there was a better place. I crawled under my father's bed. The space between the floor and the bed frame had shrunk since I was last there. Hard against one shoulder was the holiday suitcase, as grey in daylight as it was here in the dark. It held all our summer paraphernalia, sunglasses, spare film for the camera, the swimming costume that my mother never wore but never threw away. On the other side was a cardboard box. My fingers fumbled with the corrugated flaps, found a way in, and rummaged. The tangled skein of Christmas tree lights, feathers covering the skirt of the tree angel. The last time I was under this bed I had believed in Father Christmas. Now I didn't. Was that a kind of growing up? Wriggling out from under the bed, I dislodged an old biscuit tin. There it was, half sticking out from under the frill of the valance. I remembered the tin. It had been there forever. A picture of Scottish crags and firs on a lid too tight to open. Absently I tried the lid. It gave way so easily under my older, stronger fingers that I felt a pang of shock. Inside was Father's passport and various differently sized pieces of paper. Forms, part printed, part handwritten, here and there a signature. For me, to see is to read. It has always been that way. I flicked through the documents. My parents' marriage certificate, their birth certificates, my own birth certificate, red print on cream paper, my father's signature, I refolded it carefully, put it with the other forms I'd already read, and passed on to the next. It was identical. I was puzzled. Why would I have two birth certificates? Then I saw it. Same father, same mother, same date of birth, same place of birth, different name. What happened to me in that moment? Inside my head, everything came to pieces and came back together differently, in one of those kaleidoscopic reorganizations the brain is capable of. I had a twin. Ignoring the tumult in my head, my curious fingers unfolded a second piece of paper. A death certificate. My twin was dead. Now I knew what it was that had stained me. Though I was stupefied by the discovery, I was not surprised. For there had always been a feeling, the knowledge, too familiar to have ever needed words, that there was something, an altered quality in the air to my right, a coagulation of light, something peculiar to me that set empty space vibrating, my pale shadow. Pressing my hands to my right side, I bowed my head, nose almost to shoulder. It was an old gesture, one that had always come to me in pain, in perplexity, under duress of any kind. Too familiar to be pondered until now, my discovery revealed its meaning. I was looking for my twin, where she should have been, by my side. When I saw the two pieces of paper, and when the world had recovered itself enough to start turning again on its slow axis, I thought, so that's it. Loss. Sorrow. Loneliness. There was a feeling that had kept me apart from other people, and kept me company all my life. And now that I had found the certificates, I knew what that feeling was. My sister. After a long time there came the sound of the kitchen door opening downstairs. Pins and needles in my calves, I went as far as the landing, and Mrs. Robb appeared at the bottom of the stairs. "Is everything all right, Margaret?" "Yes." "You got everything you need?" "Yes." "Well, come round if you need to." "All right." "They won't be long now, your mum and dad." She left. I returned the documents to the tin and put the tin back under the bed. I left the bedroom, closing the door behind me. In front of the bathroom mirror, I felt the shock of contact as my eyes locked together with the eyes of another. My face tingled under her gaze. I could feel the bones under my skin. Later, my parents' steps on the stairs. I opened the door, and on the landing, Father gave me a hug. "Well done," he said. "Good marks all round." Mother looked pale and tired. Going out would have started one of her headaches. "Yes," she said. "Good girl."
"So how was it, sweetheart? Being home, on your own?"
"It was fine."
"Thought it would be," he said. And then, unable to stop himself, he gave me another hug, a happy two-armed affair, and kissed the top of my head. "Time for bed. And don't read too long."
"I won't." Later, I heard my parents going about the business of getting ready for bed. Father opening the medicine cupboard to find Mother's pills, filling a glass with water, his voice saying, as it so frequently did, "You'll feel better after a good night's sleep." Then the door of the guest room closed. A few moments later, the bed creaked in the other room, and I heard my father's light click off. I knew about twins. A cell that should ordinarily become one person inexplicably becomes two identical people instead. I was a twin. My twin was dead. What did that make me now? Under the covers, I pressed my hand against the silver-pink crescent on my torso, the shadow my sister had left behind. Like an archaeologist of the flesh, I explored my body for evidence of its ancient history. I was as cold as a corpse. With the letter still in my hand, I left the shop and went upstairs to my flat. The staircase narrowed at each of the three stories of books. As I went, turning out lights behind me, I began to prepare phrases for a polite letter of refusal. I was, I could tell Miss Winter, the wrong kind of biographer. I had no interest in contemporary writing. I had read none of Miss Winter's books. I was at home in libraries and archives and had never interviewed a living writer in my life. I was more at ease with dead people, and was, if the truth be told, nervous of the living. It probably wasn't necessary to put that last bit in the letter. I couldn't be bothered to make a meal. A cup of cocoa would do. Waiting for the milk to heat, I looked out of the window. In the night glass was a face so pale you could see the blackness of the sky through it. We pressed cheek to cold, glassy cheek. If you had seen us, you would have known that were it not for this glass, there was really nothing to tell us apart. Thirteen Tales. Tell me the truth. The words from the letter were trapped in my head. Trapped, it seemed, beneath the sloping ceiling of my attic flat, like a bird that has got in down the chimney. It was natural that the boy's plea should have affected me. I, who had never been told the truth, but left to discover it alone, and in secret. Tell me the truth. Quite. But I resolved to put the words and the letter out of my head. It was nearly time. I moved swiftly. In the bathroom, I soaped my face and brushed my teeth. By 7:58, I was in my nightdress and slippers, waiting for the kettle to boil. Quickly, quickly. 7:58. My hot water bottle was ready, and I filled a glass with water from the tap. Time was of the essence. For at 8:00, the world came to an end. It was reading time. The hours between 8 in the evening and 1 or 2 in the morning have always been my magic hours. Against the blue candlewick bedspread, the white pages of my open book, illuminated by a circle of lamplight, were the gateway to another world. But that night, the magic failed. The threads of plot that had been left in suspense overnight had somehow gone flaccid during the day, and I found that I couldn't care about how they would eventually weave together. I made an effort to secure myself to a strand of the plot, but as soon as I'd managed it, a voice intervened. Tell me the truth. That unpicked the knot and left it flopping loose again. My hand hovered instead over the old favourites. The Woman in White, Wuthering Heights, Jane Eyre. But it was no good. Tell me the truth. Reading had never let me down before. It had always been the one sure thing. Turning out the light, I rested my head on the pillow and tried to sleep. Echoes of a voice, fragments of a story. In the dark, I heard them louder. Tell me the truth. At 2:00 a.m, I got out of bed, pulled on some socks, unlocked the flat door, and wrapped in my dressing gown, crept down the narrow staircase and into the shop. At the back, there is a tiny room, not much bigger than a cupboard, that we use when we need to pack a book for the post. It contains a table, and on a shelf, sheets of brown paper, scissors, and a ball of string. As well as these items, there is also a plain wooden cabinet that holds a dozen or so books. The contents of the cabinet rarely change. If you were to look into it today, you would see what I saw that night. A book without a cover resting on its side. And next to it, an ugly tooled leather volume. A pair of books in Latin, standing upright, an old Bible, 3 volumes of botany, 2 of history, and a single tatty book of astronomy.
a book in Japanese, another in Polish, and some poems in Old English. Why do we keep these books apart? Why are they not kept with their natural companions on our neatly labelled shelves? The cabinet is where we keep the esoteric, the valuable, the rare. These volumes are worth as much as the contents of the entire rest of the shop. More, even. The book that I was after, a small hardback, about 4 inches by 6, only 50 or so years old, was out of place next to all these antiquities. It had appeared a couple of months ago, placed there, I imagine, by father's inadvertence, and one of these days I meant to ask him about it and shelve it somewhere. But just in case, I put on the white gloves. We keep them in the cabinet to wear when we handle the books because, by a curious paradox, just as the books come to life when we read them, so the oils from our fingertips destroy them as we turn the pages. Anyway, with its paper cover intact and its corners unblunted, the book was in fine condition, one of a popular series produced to quite a high standard by a publishing house that no longer exists. A charming volume, and a first edition, but not the kind of thing you would expect to find among the treasures. At jumble sales and village fetes, other volumes in the series sell for a few pence. The paper cover was cream and green. A regular motif of shapes like fish scales formed the background, and 2 rectangles were left plain, one for the line drawing of a mermaid, the other for the title and author's name. 13 Tales of Change and Desperation by Vida Winter. I locked the cabinet, returned the key and flashlight to their places, and climbed the stairs back to bed, book in gloved hand. I didn't intend to read. Not as such. A few phrases were all I wanted. Something bold enough, strong enough, to steal the words from the letter that kept going around in my head. Fight fire with fire, people say. A couple of sentences, a page, maybe, and then I would be able to sleep. I removed the dust jacket and placed it for safety in the special drawer I keep for the purpose. Even with gloves, you can't be too careful. Opening the book, I inhaled. The smell of old books, so sharp, so dry, you can taste it. The prologue. Just a few words. But my eyes, brushing the first line, were snared. All children mythologize their birth. It is a universal trait. You want to know someone? Heart, mind, and soul? Ask him to tell you about when he was born. What you get won't be the truth. It will be a story. And nothing is more telling than a story. It was like falling into water. Peasants and princes, bailiffs and baker boys, merchants and mermaids, the figures were all immediately familiar. I had read these stories 100, 1,000 times before. They were stories everyone knew. But gradually, as I read, their familiarity fell away from them. They became strange. They became new. These characters were not the coloured mannequins I remembered from my childhood picture books, mechanically acting out the story one more time. They were people. The blood that fell from the princess's finger when she touched the spinning wheel was wet, and it left the tang of metal on her tongue when she licked her finger before falling asleep. When his comatose daughter was brought to him, the king's tears left salt burns on his face. The stories were shot through with an unfamiliar mood. Everyone achieved their heart's desire. The king had his daughter restored to life by a stranger's kiss. The beast was divested of his fur and left naked as a man. The mermaid walked. But only when it was too late did they realize the price they must pay for escaping their destiny. Every happy ever after was tainted. Fate, at first so amenable, so reasonable, so open to negotiation, ends up by exacting a cruel revenge for happiness. The tales were brutal and sharp and heartbreaking. I loved them. It was while I was reading The Mermaid's Tale, the 12th tale,
that I began to feel stirrings of an anxiety that was unconnected to the story itself. I was distracted. My thumb and right index finger were sending me a message. Not many pages left. The knowledge nagged more insistently until I tilted the book to check. It was true. The 13th tale must be a very short one. I continued my reading, finished tale 12, and turned the page. Blank. I flicked back, forward again. Nothing. There was no 13th tale. There was a sudden rush in my head. I felt the sick dizziness of the deep-sea diver come too fast to the surface. Aspects of my room came back into view one by one. My bedspread, the book in my hand, the lamp still shining palely in the daylight that was beginning to creep in through the thin curtains. It was morning. I had read the night away. There was no 13th tale. In the shop, my father was sitting at the desk with his head in his hands. He heard me come down the stairs and looked up, white-faced. "Whatever is it?" I darted forward. He was too shocked to speak. His hands roused themselves to a mute gesture of desperation before slowly replacing themselves over his horrified eyes. He groaned. My hand hovered over his shoulder, but I'm not in the habit of touching people, so it fell instead to the cardigan that he had draped over the back of his chair. "Is there anything I can do?" I asked. When he spoke, his voice was weary and shaken. "We'll have to phone the police. In a minute. In a minute." "The police? Father, what's happened?" "A break-in." He made it sound like the end of the world. I looked around the shop, bewildered. Everything was neat and in order. The desk drawers had not been forced, the shelves not ransacked, and the window not broken. "The cabinet," he said, and I began to understand. "The 13 tales," I spoke firmly. "Upstairs, in my flat. I borrowed it." Father looked up at me. His expression combined relief with utter astonishment. "You borrowed it?"
"Yes."
"You borrowed it?"
"Yes." I was puzzled. I was always borrowing things from the shop, as he knew.
"But Vida Winter?"
And I realized that some kind of explanation was called for. I read old novels. The reason is simple. I prefer proper endings. Marriages and deaths. Noble sacrifices and miraculous restorations, tragic separations and unhoped-for reunions, great falls and dreams fulfilled. These, in my view, constitute an ending worth the wait. They should come after adventures, perils, dangers, and dilemmas, and wind everything up nice and neatly. Endings like this are to be found more commonly in old novels than new ones. So I read old novels. Contemporary literature is a world I know little of. My father had taken me to task on this topic many times during our daily talks about books. He reads as much as I do, but more widely, and I have great respect for his opinions. He's described in precise, measured words the beautiful desolation he feels at the close of novels, where the message is that there is no end to human suffering, only endurance. He has spoken of endings that are muted, but which echo longer in the memory than louder, more explosive denouements. He has explained why it is that ambiguity touches his heart more nearly than the death and marriage style of finish that I prefer. During these talks, I listen with the gravest attention and nod my head, but I always end up continuing in my old habits. Not that he blames me for it. There is one thing on which we are agreed. There are too many books in the world to read in a single lifetime. You have to draw the line somewhere. Once Father even told me about Vida Winter.
"Now there's a living writer who would suit you."
But I had never read any Vida Winter. Why should I, when there were so many dead writers I had still not discovered? except that now I had come down in the middle of the night to take the 13 tales from the cabinet. My father, with good reason, was wondering why. "I got a letter yesterday," I began. He nodded. "It was from Vida Winter." Father raised his eyebrows but waited for me to go on. "It seems to be an invitation for me to visit her, with a view to writing her biography." His eyebrows lifted by another few millimeters. "I couldn't sleep, so I came down to get the book." I waited for Father to speak, but he didn't. He was thinking, a small frown creasing his brow. After a time, I spoke again. "Why is it kept in the cabinet? What makes it so valuable?" Father pulled himself away from his train of thought to answer.
"Partly because it's the first edition of the first book by the most famous living writer in the English language, but mostly because it's flawed. Every following edition is called Tales of Change and Desperation. No mention of 13. You'll have noticed there are only 12 stories."
I nodded.
"Presumably they were originally supposed to be 13, then only 12 were submitted. But there was a mix-up with the jacket design, and the book was printed with the original title and only 12 stories. They had to be recalled.
But your copy slipped through the net.
One of a batch sent out by mistake to a shop in Dorset, where one customer bought a copy before the shop got the message to pack them up and send them back. 30 years ago, he realized what the value might be and sold it to a collector. The collector's estate was auctioned in September, and I bought it, with the proceeds from the Avignon deal."
The Avignon deal? It had taken 2 years to negotiate the Avignon deal. It was one of Father's most lucrative successes.
"You wore the gloves, of course," he asked sheepishly.
"What do you take me for?"
He smiled before continuing. "All that effort for nothing."
"What do you mean?"
"Recalling all those books because the title was wrong. Yet people